on Sunday, May 13th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl starts its 23rd Vision Festival coverage by celebrating this year's Lifetime of Achievement recipient, pianist and composer Dave Burrell. Join us as Dave Burrell shares some moments in his career. That's Sunday, May 13th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is this year's Vision Festival Lifetime Achievement honoree, pianist and composer Dave Burrell. I'd like to thank Michael Lucille Sternbach and Moon Lasso Productions for some audio that he provided from the Arts for Art Underline Salon that was recorded earlier this year on March 8th. WBAI is also in our spring membership drive. Show your support by calling 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or going to give the number 2 WBAI.org. That's give the number 2 WBAI.org. Or you can text us by entering the number 41444 and putting WBAI in the text field. That's 41444 and entering WBAI in the text field. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I want some sugar in my bowl.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with
Dave Burrell.
Dave Burrell, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and having this conversation with me.
It's my pleasure.
You had actually attended a salon was put together by the Arts for Arts folks, Patricia Nicholson Parker and William Parker, and Michael Sternbach shared the audio with me. You were in conversation with somebody named Ted and Bobby. Who were they?
Ted Daniel and Bobby Kapp. Bobby is a drummer and Ted is a cornet trumpet player.
Were you involved in having them as part of your conversation, or that was something William put together?
I was not told that they were going to surprise me. Todd Nicholson told me that there were some more folks coming, and then I was very pleasantly surprised that it was Bobby and Ted.
How long had it been since you'd gotten together?
Let me see. We had played at Siron Norris Jones's memorial, and that was several years back. Was impromptu get together right there in the church.
That was Cerrone, the bassist.
Exactly.
Yeah. I need to clarify something because I keep getting information that you were in New York and then you went to Hawaii. Now you're in Philadelphia. Were you born in New York?
No, I was born at my grandmother's house on my mom's side in Middletown, Ohio, but my parents lived in Harlem at the time, and so they wanted me to be born with the family doctor there in Ohio, and they brought me right back to Harlem.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
I understand that at the time they were not as comfortable as they felt they should have been with Harlem Hospital. This is 1940.
Okay.
Yes.
So I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
You came back to New York and you lived in Harlem, so I suspect that that contributed to your playing a lot.
Yeah, I had just recently, in the last decade, a desire to dig back into my past and my family's past and found out more about my parents meeting at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, while they were singing in the Jubilee Singers Choir there.
Oh, wow.
And my mother was the secretary for James Weldon Johnson as well.
Oh, my goodness. And you just found that out in the past 10 years or so.
Yeah, that was in my mom's diaries.
Okay.
And, of course, she died of cancer earlier, and my father remarried. So it was only recently that all of that stuff came out of storage, and some of it was archived by Monica Larson, my wife.
Oh, wow. How did she come upon wanting to, well, do the work, I guess?
She was keen on doing the work because of her collaboration on Windward Passages, the jazz opera that depicts African-American family, and that's semi-autobiographical to my experience, leaving Harlem for Hawaii and a better life. actually my dad in real life that received a Rosenwald Fellowship, as did James Weldon Johnson and my dad. This cash support from this foundation, the Rosenwald Grant, was given to my dad. He was a sociologist and worked for the Urban League as an administrator at the time. And it allowed him to come to Hawaii to study race relations.
Hmm.
So all three of us went.
Why Hawaii?
He had met Japanese Americans from Hawaii that were interned through his work in the Urban League. And they became friends and suggested my dad come there and see how all the races were getting along together. At that time, post-World War II, it was an interesting melting pot. Japanese Americans that were basically living in Hawaii, and Hawaii was a territory of the United States then, and finally became a state in 1959.
Right.
And along with Hawaii being a territory and a post-World War II destination for a lot of intellectuals, I found out also recently, there was a settlement called Palama Settlement where we lived. And it was this settlement that had people from all over the world living. My mother started teaching piano lessons there. I started taking judo and swimming there.
So when did your playing piano come into play? Because there's all of this other amazing stuff going on. Were you still a child when you went to Hawaii?
Yeah, it was 1946. I was 6 years old. I started the second grade, and I had opened some of my family's trunks and found a lot of 78s that included Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and there was one by Lucky Thompson called Cat on the Keys. And I started to try to copy Cat on the Keys, the upright piano we had at this Palama settlement. Since my mom was a piano teacher and she had this idea that let the kid do what he wants, don't make him take lessons necessarily, but I was always around music. They talked about and argued about race every night, the adults, and I was always there, and I always heard not only Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan. I can remember hearing jazz at these parties. Even if I wasn't at the party, it was still booming through the house. And then, too, I had this other 33 and a third LP of Vladimir Horowitz playing the Chopin Etudes. And for some reason, out of those trunks, those two records were laying right by the stereo I saw in a photograph that we just found.
Wow. You must have listened to them a lot.
Yeah, right. It was just a photograph of me sitting with a ukulele in a rattan chair next to an old-fashioned stereo with those two LPs on the floor.
Wow. There's something I noticed about your playing. You lean a lot toward the stride style of playing. Is that something that appealed to you? Is that something you derived from listening to those 78s?
I think it had something to do. It's in the back of my mind. I became more attracted to rhythm and blues as a teenager. Fats Domino in particular. I was aware of the records that we talked about, and it was in my musical craw. But when I hit New York City, even in Boston at Berklee School of Music in 1961, I was really astonished and motivated by Cecil Taylor, John Coltrane, and Ornette Coleman, hearing them. So all of a sudden, all these different fruits, so to speak, off of the jazz tree were interesting to me, and I was so far behind, I felt, because I had been just doing R&B, and I was on television in Honolulu and so on and so forth, playing R&B. And then I became serious at 21 to go into jazz, really, hook, line, and sinker.
You know, I actually noticed on your first release as a leader, I guess, High One, High Two, those selections seem rather radio-friendly, shall we say.
Yeah, right. It's kind of a funny story, but in Honolulu, my parents' friends would say, well, this kid really is great at boogie-woogie. He's doing this high school thing, and I think I had won second prize at the Waikiki Shell with my trio for playing boogie-woogie, and said, why don't you put put him on the Ed Sullivan Show, and somebody knew somebody, and all of a sudden, a little later, not when I was in high school, but we met with folks from Ed Sullivan, and I played for a woman, and she said, "That's great. Do you sing?" And I said, "No." That was the end of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, I mean, you know, that's how naive we were about how you made it.
Now, I mentioned your first release as a leader. You know, of course, I'm going to have to go back to what you did before that, because you worked a lot before you decided to record as a leader, it appears. But I noticed on the release, High 1, High 2, you have Cerrone, as we mentioned before, the basses. Farrell yeah. Sanders is on tambourine, and Bobby Capp, who was at the Salon, on drums.
Right.
And
sure.
Sonny Murray was also on drums on the recording.
Yeah.
What was the decision for you to record?
I talked to Alan Douglas, the producer, and Alan Douglas at the time had a label called Douglas International, right, where he had recorded Malcolm X speeches,
right,
John F. Kennedy speeches, and done various groups that were from Woodstock's big festival.
Right. He also recorded The Last Poets.
Oh, The Last Poets. That's a good example. And he said, "I'd like to record you. What do you want to do?" And I thought, well, I've been working on this West Side Story medley. And he said, well, I know Leonard Bernstein and can bring him over and he can check you out. And I said, well, I'm doing it with Bobby Capp, Norris Jones, known as Cerrone, and Farrell Sanders. And he said, well, I want you in trio. So I said, well, I've been working with Farrell on this music for a long, long time, so I'm going to have to make sure that he gets on there some way. And that's why he was on tambourine.
Okay.
I think the main focus of my first initiative as leader, but I had these other pieces that were kind of, I thought, funky, like you said, radio friendly. And he was just letting the tape roll. We were getting as much material or footage as we could possibly have. And I was so new to recording that I was just piling up far more than for one record.
Right.
Yeah. And so the West Side Story on one side and then East Side Colors on the other side with Sonny Murray was what I wanted to do. And the funky little songs, I didn't know if they were any good at the time. And then I was assured by the company that they liked those little songs, too.
It's interesting. What I'm looking at is it actually turned out to be two LPs.
Yeah.
The way they have it here, though, is the West Side Story, as you mentioned, on one side. On the other, it had the little songs, as you put them.
Oh, yeah.
And then they had East Side Colors on the second album. And
I see.
They referred to it as a theme stream medley of the little songs all together. I don't even... Do you remember recording it as a medley, the little songs?
I don't really remember, and that's not my term, theme stream. First, it came out on Douglas as one LP.
Okay.
One, yeah, it was one record only.
Okay.
It wasn't a duo, but I think his catalog was sold to Arista, you know, and that's how we got the other material.
I see. Another situation where marketing ruled what actually wound up on the recordings in order to make money.
Yes. I think I was called by Mr. Kuskuna and Stanley Crouch, and they talked about how good it was, and I was given more money, and that became this Arista new catalog and new packaging.
Got it. Because it was originally released in, 1969, 1968?
Yeah, I think 68.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is pianist, composer, and Vision Festival 23 honoree for his lifetime of achievement, Dave Burrell. What you're listening to in the background is the West Side Story medley from Dave Burrell's debut release as a leader, High 1, High 2, originally released in 1968 on Douglas Black Lion Records. This is from a 1976 Arista Freedom reissue. Dave Burrell on piano, Cerrone Norris Jones on bass, Farrell Sanders on tambourine, and Bobby Capp on drums. Before that, we heard Uzi Uzi, also from High 1, High 2. Before that, we heard Margie Pargie, A.M. Rag, also from High 1, High 2. Before that, we heard I Want to See You Every Day of My Life from Dave Burrell's Windward Passages release. This was originally recorded in 1979. This is from a 1994 Hat Hut Records release. Dave Burrell on solo piano, and Monica Larson is the librettist. Unfortunately, none of the words were ever recorded as a release, but you need to know Monica Larson was the librettist. Before that, we heard About Face from Dave Burrell and Full Blown Trio from the High 2 2004 release expansion. Dave Burrell on piano, William Parker on bass, and Andrew Cyril on drums. And, of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams will be coming up. But before we get there, and so we could also hear more from this West Side Story medley, I need to remind you that WBAI is in its spring membership drive, and we need your support. We need you to call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or you can go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org. Or you can use your cell phone to enter the number 41444 and text WBAI. That's the number 41444 and put WBAI into the text field. Send it to us and you will be able to show your financial support for this listener-supported experiment. You can become a sustaining member by becoming a WBAI buddy, and you can find out more about that by contacting us at 516-620-3602 or going to give2wbai.org or entering 41444 and placing WBAI into the text field. You could also go to sugarinmybowl.org, and we have all the information up there. As a matter of fact, Hank Williams will be telling you a little bit about that during our On the Bandstand segment. After the West Side Story medley, we're going to play Dave Blue, also from High 1, High 2. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for May 13th. This segment features area listings of Sugar My Bowl guests, so you can see them live. And this week's guest is pianist Dave Burrell. He's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's Vision Fest, and will be performing in three different combos on Vision's opening night at Roulette in downtown Brooklyn on May 23rd. Drummer Andrew Surreal joins Burrell for the Harlem Renaissance Suite. Later that night, he reunites with saxophonist Archie Shepp, then leads a quartet in the closing set with James Brandon Lewis, Kid Jordan, and William Parker. And we'll have more Vision Fest details at the bottom of our segment. And this is normally the time when we go into the shows of the week, and we'll do that in a moment. But WBAI Radio's Spring Fun Drive is underway, and it desperately needs your support to stay on the air and keep this show on the air. There are three ways you can help. You can call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602 while we're on the air, or pledge online at give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org, or you can send a text message to 41444 and enter transmit 995 in the message field. You can pledge as little as $5 or consider becoming a sustaining member with a monthly pledge, and I'll repeat all that at the bottom of the segment after our listings. We start with bassist Ron Carter, who's at the Blue Note from May 14th through 16th. Pianist Vijay Iyer is at the Village Vanguard from the 15th through the 30th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio in a late set at Smalls on the 16th. Vocalist Tana Alexa is at the Jazz Gallery on the 17th and is joined by drummer Antonio Sanchez. Bassist Alex Blake leads an ensemble at Smalls on the 18th. Saxophonist Renee McLean is at the Side Door in Old Lyme, Connecticut for a Jackie McLean tribute on the 18th. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis leads a trio at Harlem's Greater Calvary Baptist Church, and that's part of the Harlem Jazz Box series on the 18th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns for late night sets at Smoke on the 18th and 25th. Saxophonist David Murray leads a Class Struggle Ensemble with trombonist Craig Harris at the Village Vanguard from the 19th through the 25th. Looking a little further ahead, saxophonist Tia Fuller leads a quartet at Dizzy's Club on the 22nd. Vocalist Renee Marie is at Birdland from the 24th to the 26th, then heads up to the Side Door in Connecticut on the 27th. Drummer Will Calhoun leads a quartet at Dizzy's Club on the 28th. The Sun Ra Orchestra, led by Marshall Allen, returns to Earth on the 30th at Iridium to celebrate Marshall's 94th birthday. Lastly, the Vision Festival's 23rd annual showcase of avant-garde jazz, poetry, dance, and visual art runs from the 21st through the 28th. Kicks off with a film festival on the 21st at Anthology Film Archives, then shifts to Roulette for nightly sets from the 23rd to the 28th. Highlights include Mary Halverson's Code Girl Project, Faye Victor's Mutations for Justice, Francisco Morakatlet's Afro Horn, Craig Harris's Brown Butterfly Suite, and Oliver Lake's Big Band on the final night. There were also afternoon panel discussions on the topic of the struggle for cultural equity in New York's music communities on the 27th and Memorial Day the 28th. We've linked to the full schedule on our blog and have a preview and continuing event coverage online. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on the blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge at 516-620-3602 while we're on the air, online at give2wbai.org, or sending a text message to 41444 with transmit 995 in the message field. The support WBAI link on our site has details, and we'll be grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and are scheduled to be back on air on Sunday, May 27th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Now, I'm going to go back again to mm-hmm. your developing stages. At what point did you come back to New York from Hawaii?
I was in first Boston from 61 to 65. I graduated from Berkeley, and I came back to New York City and moved into a loft on the Bowery. That was August of 1965.
What was life like at Berkeley as a student?
It was small, a small school with a very warm family feeling. Mm. And we were all just having a lot of attention because there were hardly any students compared to the way the school is now.
Wow.
You had people like Keith Jarrett there. I was a freshman when Gary Burton was a senior.
Wow.
He still lived in the dormitory where I lived, and there were practice rooms downstairs. Everybody talked music, chord changes. We studied subjects like composition of Duke Ellington and the bebop phenomena of Charlie Parker and so on.
Wow.
The experts were the drum teacher like Alan Dawson, mm-hmm. who was working also with Dave Brubeck. Let's see, Herb Pomeroy, the great arranger, was teaching Ellington voicings like the train whistle voicing that was famous for its revolutionary use of the kind of orchestra that was evolving from the 50s, you know, the big band phenomena that went all the way from Canada and stretched all the way across the United States with Kent and Ferguson and Basie and Duke, for example, Fletcher mm-hmm. Henderson, Benny Goodman, and all. So the day-to-day phenomena with the kind of talk you would hear would be, Miles Davis just recorded Milestones, and that's based on modes instead of chord changes. Mm-hmm. And the skeptics were saying, what do you mean? How can you just improvise on a mode? You know, don't you need a chord, you know? And then you had George Russell, and you had the third stream phenomena, and you had students that were taking too many credits of academia, so they didn't have time to practice.
Oh.
Their parents wanted them to get this degree, and they wanted to be having much less of the academic workload.
Somebody during the salon had made a comment about the difference between playing life and playing academia. Is that something you can speak to?
I think it can be interpreted a lot of ways. Garrison Fuel was, before his recent death, had written a book. He was a guitar teacher at the Berkeley that we know now, and he became a good friend of ours, he and his wife. And his book was on free jazz and avant-garde jazz, and it had been translated into several languages. He interviewed musicians, including myself and William Parker, about where do you get this justification to the way that you're playing free. A lot of people say, well, you know, it's just a spirituality. And I gave examples of Coltrane's Love Supreme and on through Ascensions and so on. But at the time in 1961 to 1965, before Garrison Fuel was a teacher, I was there at Berkeley, and I was influenced by my colleagues from all different backgrounds at all different levels of development. And I remember in particular a baritone saxophone player from South Carolina named Emmett Simmons, who was called after a year to join James Brown. And he joined that phenomena and came back and shared with us different kinds of bass lines that he had mastered. I was also really into the Ray Charles phenomena and his orchestra, big band, and his small groups with the Raylettes. I saw them in Cincinnati, Ohio at Castle Farm, and I later
So wherein lies the difference between playing life and playing academia?
That was the original question.
Right.
Yeah. So I thought that if, you know how one doesn't have control over what experience you're going to be confronted with, it's right on your doorstep that you can't avoid, say like the Ray Charles and the James Brown and the Ornette and Miles and Train all came at me in smidgens and sometimes in truckloads. Say, can you take this after-hour gig and still be a student and work down at this lounge? And the answer was, well, let me try.
Great.
You know, and come to school with dark glasses on and, you know, smoking Pall Malls with an oversized leather coat that my uncle gave me. But I was all in.
Yeah.
And studying and did some of my friends' homework sometimes. Everybody was good at something. And I had bad handwriting, but I was good at writing music notes.
Wow. Did you eventually wind up teaching?
I did teach at the old Garvey headquarters on 123rd and Lenox.
Wow.
I taught kids and rehabilitated prisoners.
You know, that was mentioned during the salon, visiting prisons. I think you mentioned you were playing with Archie Shepp at the time.
A little bit of community volunteer work, nonprofit work, and the passion was there, and suddenly the funds dried up. It really came right at 1970, I think, was the peak of community thing, and there were prisoners that we were rehabilitating from Sing Sing, and it was my job to go and talk to the prisoners and see which ones were musically inclined. I was afraid of them, but I still went in to the arena, so to speak, and they used to call me Little Red. So, okay, Little Red, you know, don't be afraid. It was a kind of a humiliating but still necessary, because I thought I was going to have that job for a long time, you know. During that time, I grew leaps and bounds. My confidence went up because these guys, some of them were triple life and they got pardoned. So right around the time we went up to Attica and played in Danbury and Walla Walla. So we were playing maximum security prisons a lot.
It was with Archie?
Yeah, sometimes with Archie. Sometimes with Sam River, Billy Blackwell.
And when you play these prison gigs, just to add a note, when they say, we like that piece, play it again, you play it right away.
Immediately.
Immediately. But when I was doing the Philadelphia maximum prison system for a while, every prison I went into, no matter where it was, they said, hey, you know Sonny Merritt? You know Sonny Merritt? You know.
Dude.
You know, and so Sonny knew a lot of people, you know, and some of us happened to be in prison.
Was that a different situation when you wound up teaching?
No, it was in addition to gigging. You know, when I first met Archie, I think he was at the University of Buffalo, and when he wasn't teaching, he was there on that campus commuting from the Lower East Side where he lived at 27 Cooper Square. And what I was doing was Gratian Moncourt III's, his wife Tracy's mom was in charge of a nonprofit called Community Thing. So a couple of times a week I was there, and that meant I was free to be downtown too. But I had bought a brownstone on Hamilton Terrace, and so I had moved from Lower East Side back up to Harlem. I was already doing some stuff with Archie, some playing with Pharoah and Marion Brown, Giuseppe Logan, because nobody had steady work. I had a group with Sonny Murray of my own.
Right.
And a singer from Harlem named Dupree Washington, and we played at Lincoln Center, and I had a painter painting while we played.
Wow.
And it really worked. I've just ran into a painter the other day, MacArthur Binion, who said, "Remember when you guys were at Lincoln Center and the painter Clarence Hagens from Virginia, I think it was Richmond, splash paint all over you?" And I said, "Yeah, I remember that."
Wow.
And Wilson of the Times, Mr. Wilson, said, "Space Age Electronic Jazz." And I thought, wow, this is a great review, and I can run with this review and get more work. But the work didn't come, and especially not that level of work.
But I know how I feel, crucificado. When I think of my hate, I'm finished with love. I wonder, resurrection from the dead is splendor. Through in life and you, like my surrender.
finished with love, I wonder. Resurrection from the dead is splendor.
Start to embrace this free way of expressing yourself musically?
I think the Pan-African Festival in Algiers in 1969, I think it was August that we went there through the State Department. We were all-stars, I'd say, under the umbrella of Archie Shepp's phenomena, because he had already started Inside, Outside, and been embraced by John Coltrane in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Since that was already considered to be, okay, you know, a little bit free is all right, but, you know, you don't want to go just wild. But the civil rights movement was dictating in a way that, okay, the beboppers are wearing suits or sports coats and ties, and we're wearing dashikis.
Right.
And we're embracing our heritage, and we need to go further. So with that kind of mindset, along with the women's movement and the civil rights movement, the forests of the left, the prison injustices from the standpoint of the music had to be high energy, and at least in my mind at the time, it seemed okay to go off the page of the written composition and be able to still make sense.
Okay.
So I was always looking for, since I had heard Cecil Train and even Sonny Rollins, go to the next step after bebop.
Wow. I'm looking at a recording you were on, as was Archie Shepp, with Clifford Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually has a selection that he calls Pan-African Festival. Have any memories about Clifford Thornton and that recording?
Clifford was a dear friend. He stayed with me after Pan-African Festival in Harlem, and he joined us from Timbuktu, where he was living, and Archie said, come on, play with us, and so he became part of the front line, along with Ted Jones, the poet, writer, and we all felt the validation of what we were pushing in Manhattan as the next music that we as African Americans were in charge of, and radical New Yorkers like Stokely Carmichael were at that festival, and so were the Black Panthers.
Right.
I played for other events, not only in Algiers but in Paris, for everything that was represented in the civil rights movement, I think, in general. And it wasn't something that you felt like you were doing something that was unacceptable or wrong. You felt that you were not having the kind of representation in your own country that you should be having.
All right. bati de men. Omala, 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 omala bati de men. Omala, 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 omala bati de men. Omala, omala,
omala, omala bati de men. Omala, omala.
On this recording that I was talking about, and I guess generally, Clifford Thornton plays cornet. He was also playing congas on this recording.
Oh, sure, yeah. And it seemed after Algiers and the phenomena of hearing everything from all African countries represented in one big festival and finding out about books like Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, just suddenly became intellectually moved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess with all of that going on and living in Harlem, you had some sort of exposure to what was referred to as the Black Arts Movement?
Yes, in many ways. I was in the Sikh program under Bill Sales.
Oh.
I taught at Queens College. I came back from Algiers and my class on improvisation, I taught sitting on the floor the way that I had done in the Sahara Desert.
Oh.
And they didn't like that. What are you sitting on the floor for? And I said that this is the way that the music was presented, and I'm going into complete giving of my experience, and I thought I would feel a lot more comfortable on the floor the way I did yesterday. I was called in and briefed on why I should not sit on the floor.
Oh, goodness. Wow. Were you also involved directly in Black Arts Repertory Theater or anything with the meeting, Baraka?
I think there was one opportunity where I subbed at the BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, for Stanley Cowell in a play called Lady Day, and that involved Archie Shepp and many other people, I think, even maybe Calvin Massey.
Wow.
But between the Sikh program for equality in education for Black and Puerto Rican students, Edgar White, playwright, who is working with Joseph Papp at the Shakespeare Festival Theater down on Lafayette, the plays by, at that time, Leroy Jones, mm-hmm. what he was working on, what the theater on 4th Street, La Mama was having, what Studio Rivvy was doing with Sam and the Rivers. But I was very much working on these different projects with colleagues until I had to go on a road. And each and every time there was a gig in Europe, I'd drop everything and leave. And that's what most of us were able to do, that we weren't married and we needed the experience and the money.
Right. Wow. You mentioned Studio Rivvy. Could you tell me about the 1977 Douglas Records Wildflowers sessions?
Yes, that was another phenomena because it just validated so many of the newer arrivals to New York City. And the way that it was handled, the way that it started out, there were protests by musicians that were old-time established New Yorkers that felt that they should be included, but that was only one argument. There were a lot of other things that I didn't know about and still don't know, but I did receive a phone call from Michael Cuscuna to come down there and play with Roswell Rudd. And when I did come down, Roswell Rudd's thing went real well, but then Michael Cuscuna asked me to do something on my own, and I did a piece called Black Robert.
Yes.
And Black Robert, Archie, and I will play on the 23rd of May at the Vision Festival in Brooklyn at Roulette.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, that will be the day that Vision Festival will bestow its Lifetime of Achievement honor to you.
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited about it and very humbled by it.
Now, to focus on the 23rd Vision Festival and that evening, there are several performances that are happening. Do you want to go into what they are and how they became part of that celebration?
Yes. The first set, 7 to 7:45, will be my Harlem Renaissance ensemble, which includes Darius Jones on alto sax, Steve Swell on trombone, Harrison Bankhead bass, and Andrew Cyril drums. We will play three selections. The first one it's called Paradox of Freedom from the American Civil War Project at the Rosenbach Research Museum and Library here in Philly. And that composition of mine will feature Darius. So very excited about that. And then at 8, Archie Shepp will have the next set, and he asked me in a phone call from Paris if I could send him Crucificado, my composition, with lyrics. So I don't know if he wants to sing it, but I remember when he was singing other compositions, we had a lot of fun, and probably if he doesn't sing, we definitely are going to play Crucificado.
You know, I didn't know that that was your composition. Was it Jolie Wilson was the vocalist?
Yeah, Jolie was beautiful on that. One of the very first interpretations of it. So we have Crucificado, Margie Pargie, another rag of mine.
Yes.
And then Black Robert that was recorded at the Wildflowers thing, that collection recorded at the venue of Studio Rivby of Sam Rivers.
Right. And Hamid Drake is on drums and William Parker is on bass.
Yeah, exactly. So we're very excited about uniting again with Archie. And I think for William, it's the first time.
Oh, wow. I'm truly looking forward to that one.
That's me too.
Fire!
Yeah. And then the last set will be Kid Jordan on tenor saxophone and James Brandon Lewis on saxophone and William Parker and Andrew Cyril again.
That's right.
With me.
Wow.
Mm.
That quintet, that is another one that I'm really looking forward to.
Do you know
what type of music you're doing, or it's just you're going to just open the door and go?
That's very well put, Joyce. open the door and go. Yeah. That's what it'll be. The last set will be completely free.
Excellent. Oh, wow. Mm. Well, congratulations on the honor and for, unlike the NEA Jazzmaster, not that I have a problem with this concept. You know, when Archie Shepp received his NEA Jazzmaster honor and we interviewed him, he was saying how they don't have you sing for your supper. So I wouldn't be able to hear him play that evening. Essentially, that's what he was saying. But with this, even though you're being honored, it is an honor for the audience, I believe, to be able to hear you in action.
I see and feel the phenomenon, the buzz, and talking it up, and I'm getting calls from dear friends and old friends that I haven't heard from for a long time congratulating me, and I'm just very happy about the whole thing.
And Kid Jordan had received an honor as well some years back from the Vision Festival.
Yeah, and he just recently received the Satchmo Award at Columbia University.
Beautiful. Yay. I think you joined the Vision Festival probably during the 4th?
Yeah, either the 4th or the 5th. We played duets, me and David Murray, when it was moved to 8th Street between 2nd Avenue and the Bowery.
Wonderful. And you've recorded a lot with David Murray. Did you come upon David Murray just being around New York and you just decided to work together? Or how'd that start?
I think I went to hear him at the Wildflower set that he did. And I never got to congratulate him to say how much I enjoyed his playing. He had just come from California. I think he arrived with the drummer. And from that time on, we kind of were thinking about, yeah, why don't we play together when the opportunity comes up? Then suddenly he had a whole lot of gigs with quartet, quintet, and octet. And we were at Sweet Basil a couple of weeks a year, you know. And we recorded a lot for a Japanese label called DIW.
Yes. Now, you said with the drummer. Was this drummer Stanley Crouch at that time?
It was Stanley.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
But we actually have this recording, my partner and I, Hank. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing him drum, and that's a different Stanley Crouch.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they came, they were very, very forceful in their arrival, and we would go to Roberta Garrison's loft in Soho every Wednesday night with painters and other musicians. Let's see, Ronnie Matthews, I remember in particular, Eddie Jefferson would come with Gration from Newark.
Okay.
And we would cook a big meal every Wednesday. I was teaching Jimmy Garrison's daughter and son piano lessons.
Wow.
We had a good time, a lot of painters, contemporary painters. MacArthur Binion was there a lot. And during that time, people like Stanley Crouch and David Murray and Henry Threadgill came to New York and came to the loft of Roberta Garrison and Jimmy Garrison.
Wow. You know, I could listen to you for hours. Just talk about that period, that time in New York. There's one thing I do want. I noticed that you, well, of course, you're now in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
When did you decide to make that move there?
Oh, I came back from Sweden. We have a country house there, Monty and I. And when we returned, we felt that the rent in New York was too high.
Oh.
So we wanted a lower rent, and I wanted to go back in the woodshed. And Philadelphia was, we thought at the time, very much on the top of our list of places that we could work out of there and wasn't too far from New York. So we moved into a carriage house in Southwest Philly that was owned by Jerome Hunter, the bass player. He was playing with Shirley Scott at the time.
So what is the Philly jazz scene like right now?
Well, the jazz scene, it has peaks and valleys, you know. When the Coltrane celebrations of last year, when they were being celebrated along with Mark Chrisman's Ars Nova October Revolution, there was a lot of folks here from New York and all over the world participating. The art ensemble was put back together to some degree, and Anthony Braxton played solo. I played for VIP guests, solo piano. And William Parker has had projects down here that were very well received. And Sonny Murray's memorial concert at the Philadelphia Clef Club was an event that turned out to be very, very important to Philly's jazz scene. And Berklee College of Music has auditions periodically there at the Clef Club.
Do you feel like you still need to come to New York and go to Europe to get what you need?
Yeah, I do. I always felt that way. And it's kind of like I have the best of both worlds because I get to go to New York every week when I'm in Philly. And I still consider myself to be international.
Right.
So it's not really just one thing that can hold me down, I think, in any town.
Cool. Do you have any interaction with the Sun Ra Orchestra while in Philly?
I do. I used to live across the street from the Sun Ra Orchestra when Sonny was alive on East 3rd Street between 1st and 2nd Avenues. And right there, I'd go across from my place on 3rd Street and go and listen to Sun Ra and the orchestra rehearse. Then I played with Sonny at Central Park. musicians in the park, and he did it.
Wow.
And I played hand percussion that he gave me to play. You know, that was the first time they had 100 musicians in Central Park.
Was it at the band shell?
Yeah, that band shell.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
I think I was actually referring to, while you're in Philadelphia, do you have interaction with the orchestra?
I did. Marshall Allen, in particular. I've sat in. I haven't kept track of when these opportunities pop up. Okay. Periodically at the Empty Foxhole and so on, other venues, a local art gallery up by University of Pennsylvania and so on.
Tell me about Full Blown. You had a trio called Full Blown. You have a Full Blown Rhapsody that you're performing at the Vision Festival.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I didn't get to finish that part of the description of the first set. I only told you about the Paradox of Freedom composition. Full Blown Rhapsody was the second composition, and Red Summer March was the third, that 45-minute set that we do. And the Rhapsody is a tribute to the writers, musicians, and dancers of the Renaissance and how that just gave all of African-American artists that I came up with a reason to be proud and to continue to grow and evolve.
You know, I was thinking that when I heard a recording of that. Did you play that at the Salon?
I did, a part of it.
It started off as, it was powerfully proud. That was the feeling that I wrote down that I heard. And then it went into some sort of rag, it seemed. And then it went back into the melody. Now, is there some type of commentary of the present state of affairs?
Well, what you said, thank you for writing that. Proud is what I wanted the takeaway to be, at least in part. And those different sections, you know, I've never really heard it back privately in a way that I can say, this section here is African / Caribbean, and this section here is just full blown. And we needed all of the other strains in order to get the momentum for the full-blown finale.
So is that a way of sort of saying that it takes everybody to make a world?
Well put. But, I mean, when you say Harlem Renaissance, when I started researching along with Monica Larsson, Swedish writer-poet librettist, she was recommending, well, why don't you read Red Summer? And then the imagery started to come to me because of the description in Red Summer by Cameron McWhirter, the imagery of lynchings, frustration and disappointments in legislation in this country. It made me identify with conversations that were so taken by me as a little boy very seriously about what had happened to my parents, the prejudice that they had faced in their life as students or just going to Fisk University during the Great Depression with sandwiches in a shoebox, you know, those kinds of things.
And for the listeners, for their own records, that Dave Burrell is referring to Red Summer, the summer of 1919, and the awakening of Black America by Cameron McWhirter, McWhirter.
Yes, thanks to us. Langston Hughes's book, well, many books, but in particular a book by Mr. Hughes that has the flirtation with communism and his world travels, sometimes in some chapters, just overwhelming what he did trying to drink in everything that he was experiencing as an African-American artist, writer, that was in conversations in the Renaissance period with international people. I didn't want the book to end. I just got so motivated by his, Monty's bringing me the book right now.
I was just going to ask.
I I wonder as I wander.
Okay.
Yeah. And then along this way, James Weldon Johnson, his autobiography.
Right.
So with James Weldon Johnson, like I said, my mom was his secretary there at Fisk. And I was also just putting all of these great African-American heroes that are very close to my own family in many ways, because we left the United States and went somewhere else and still represented the United States. And I felt like I had to put something like that into the Rhapsody and into the Red Summer March.
Is there a plan during this Vision Festival presentation, I guess sort of world premiere of these pieces, is there a plan to record and release what is presented at the Vision Festival?
Yes, this will be the first opportunity to really hear it back, the arrangements, and then to build on the piece, well, I should say the project, with even more of the same kind of improvisation and write more compositions, compose more material.
Well, that is wonderful to hear. Is there anything else you want to share with the WBAI listening audience that we may not have talked about? Because there's so much that I want to talk about.
Yeah, I'm sure that there is. I just want to say that we had a great rehearsal, looking forward to rehearsing and talking with Archie Shepp, William Parker, Hamid Drake. Every time we get together, all the musicians, we just feel that it's so necessary to have this unity.
Well, that's one thing I appreciate about the Vision Festival. When all of you musicians get together, my partner and I, we call it Hajj.
Beautiful. It is so important. And then, too, Kid Jordan is up in his 80s, and we just were so excited to have him with young James Brandon Lewis.
Yes. It's so interesting, as I'm talking to you and you're talking about who's going to be part of that day, many of those persons, including James Brandon Lewis, have been guests on this program. So I'm glad to add your name to the list of people who've been on this program as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Dave Burrell. And we'll see you on May 23rd at Roulette in Brooklyn.
Listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is an excerpt from the full-blown Rhapsody, which was provided by Michael Lucio Sternbach for Moon Lasso Productions from an Arts for Art underlined salon that was recorded on March 18th. Dave Burrell on solo piano. Before that, we heard Pan-African Festival from Clifford Thornton. Quechua, I think that's how it's pronounced. Quechaoua is the name of the 1969 BYG Actual Records release. Clifford Thornton on cornet, congas, Archie Shepp on soprano saxophone, Dave Burrell on piano, Gretchen Moncourt III on trombone, Arthur Jones on alto saxophone, Beb Gurin on bass, Earl Freeman also on bass, and Sonny Murray on drums. Before that, we heard Crucificado, which is a Dave Burrell composition. It's from Archie Shepp and the Attica Blues Big Band, live at, I really can't pronounce this, but see, that's the good part about following us on Facebook, where the playlist is available, or visiting our website, sugarmybowl.org. But it's somewhere in France. Originally recorded in 1967, this is from a 1993 release on Blue Marge Records. The soloists are, in order, Charles Majid Greenlee on trombone. He's also the arranger and conductor. Archie Shepp on tenor saxophone. Joe Lee Wilson is the vocalist. And before that, we heard an excerpt from the Arts for Art Underline Salon panel discussion that took place on March 8th earlier this year and was provided by Michael Lucio Sternbach for Moon Lasso Productions. The speakers in order are Dave Burrell and William Parker. Before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. As mentioned, WBAI is in membership mode, and we could use your support by calling 516-620-3602, or go to give, the number 2, WBAI.org. That is give, the number 2, WBAI.org. Or you can text us by entering the number 41444 and placing WBAI into the text field. That's 41444. And WBAI goes into the text field. It will give you instruction on how to show your support. Three wonderful ways where you can help us. And you can also consider becoming a sustaining member by being a WBAI buddy. All you have to do is set it up and forget it. You will just help us and you won't even have to think about it again. Stay tuned. La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled next. We are scheduled to return on May 27th, the evening before the last Vision Festival series of events. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.